Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. Thea is here. I am here.
Hello.
Hello. We're ready to go. Thea, how are you?
I'm okay. I'm well, thank you.
How is Alf?
He is also well. Yeah, he's
properly. Is he taking fine. His little cone off?
Oh yes, that's long gone. Is thankfully, it? He's doing well. He's getting more confident every day.
So it's gonna.
He's a bit of a dick.
Oh no! Why?
No, only when people come to the house. It's fine.
What does he
do? Unless people come to the house, he's very loud about it.
Oh.
He offers a commentary.
Is he getting
of their every movement?
But I wonder whether, because he's never had security until now. Maybe he's getting
he's
sort of
finally
possessive.
Found a home of his own.
Yeah, and maybe he
which
wants
is very
to...
on theme with today's podcast.
It is. It is about Alf's room of one's own for Alf. I'd like to meet him. How big is he?
Oh, he'd hate you.
Oh,
because you're very tall and bearded, which is his worst.
Yeah. Well, that's true for so many other people as well. So he's in good company. Here's the bit where I encourage you to subscribe to the TLS. Use this special offer code and get on board. the-tls.co.uk/podcast offer. That's podcast offer. It's the best price anywhere on the internet. 5 issues for £5 or $5. Coming up this week, we're firmly in the grip of film awards season and we have a review of Marriage Story in the paper. So we thought we'd get in Muriel Zagger, who wrote it, the review, not the film, and arts editor Lucy Dallas to talk about prize-winning movies. This month marks the 200th anniversary of the birth of Anne Bronte, the sister whose reputation has been slowest to blossom. But in The Tenant of Wildfell Hall, the sister who has written a novel best suited perhaps to our modern sensibility. Samantha Ellis will make the case. And Thea has been chatting to author Francesca Wade about her book Square Hauntings, reviewed by Anne Kennedy Smith this week. It's the story of five women whose lives intersected in one London location. We'll hear a bit from the interview in this podcast and you'll get the whole thing on the podcast feed too. Noah Baumbach is a laureate of East Coast artistic intellectual angst. His film Marriage Story, nominated for a whole bunch of Oscars this week, is perhaps the best distillation of his film preoccupations, the power of relationships to be misunderstood, and its impact on the family. It's a divorce movie with nods to Kramer versus Kramer, of course, but in terms of its feel, it also owes something to early Woody Allen, you know, when he was good. It is, in effect, an inverted romantic comedy. It begins with a couple, Charlie and Nicole, played by Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson, saying their favourite things about each other. Ah, but not in the grip of love in the office of a divorce arbitrator. Marriage Story is really a breakup story, charting the effect on the couple and the son and the evil machinations of the divorce lawyer industry. Muriel Zagger has reviewed it and is here with us now alongside indie pop star Lucy Dallas so we can debate the state of the film industry in Oscar nomination week. Muriel, hello.
Hello.
Lucy, hello.
Hello.
And we've seen quite a lot of the Oscar nominated films, so we're going to give all that a go. Shall we start, Muriel, with Marriage Story? It's been very widely feted. Is it as good as all that? I watched it and I kind of came out thinking that's a very nicely made, low-key, medium-sized film about divorce in New York. Good luck to it. And that was it.
I watched it cold. That's to say, although I had seen other films by him, I didn't know how fated it was or was going to be. So perhaps I went in with slightly lower expectations. And I did think it was very good and that it was an interest. It benefits hugely from its star casting. And I find it quite a teasing experience to see such huge stars as the ubiquitous Adam Driver, who has to be in everything because that's the law now, yeah, clearly, and Scarlett Johansson, who's managed to step outside of the Black Widow franchise, although not for very long. It's very nice to see these huge stars in the confines of a smaller story. Yeah. So actually the minor key there, I thought, worked very well. There's a scene where they come home from probably a session with their marriage counsellor, and the babysitter's waiting for them. And it's a bit of a them and us scene, because the babysitter is very ordinary looking, like, you know, most people are. And as they walk in, Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson, she says, "You guys are just so attractive." And so she voices what the audience is thinking all the way through, that these people are abnormally good looking. And yet,
is Adam Driver abnormally good looking? He's interesting
he's
looking.
He's interesting.
Yeah.
He's,
this is not the podcast message.
Well, you want to look at him.
Yeah, that's true. He uses a sense of attractive that you want to look at him.
Noah Baumbach loves him. And because he's not, this is not the only film that he's done with him. And
he's in While We're Young.
He was. Yes. I interviewed Noah Baumbach, and I said, "Is sort of Adam Driver your male muse?" And he kind of said, "Yes." When they make films like this one, they're already talking about the next thing they want to do. So I kind of, he feels that he's integral to the movie.
He's found his film alter ego, maybe in a sort of François Truffaut, Jean-Pierre Léo sort of way. Where
I'm interested in that.
Younger self there.
There is, all his movies feel a bit alter ego-y. They're all kind of intellectual, slightly pseudo-intellectual New York East Coast artists. Is that a plus or a minus? Because partially it makes it feel even smaller to me. It's sort of the preoccupations of, you know, these theatre types.
I think it's a plus, because there is something perhaps sadistically enjoyable about watching people with pretensions and delusions about themselves mercilessly skewered. Marriage Story has perhaps less of that in a way. It's a gentler film, although it is brutal about marriage. It is gentler on its characters, I think, and more even-handed. But I remember the scene in Margot at the Wedding where Nicole Kidman plays a writer who is very successful, and then she's being interviewed in the bookshop by another writer, and it's going to be terrific. And then she's asked whether a very unpleasant psychopathic character in her novel is actually based on herself, or she thought she'd based it on her father. And that's a moment, it's very painful to watch, but there is also something perversely satisfying about watching people knocked off their pedestal.
It's also, it doesn't matter whether we relate to them or not, because it's the job of the film to make you care about them. So it doesn't matter what they do and
where they
live. Well,
you've seen most recently, Lucy. You boned up on it by watching it last night.
I did indeed.
And did you like it?
I did like it. I did like it.
Yeah. You're not much good at this reviewing game, aren't you?
How many popcorns
would Adam Miles Jones give it?
I'm just trying to think about it. I thought that, partly because of the hype as well, it would be terribly moving and affecting, and a bit like, I suppose, you know, a bit like Kramer versus Kramer and all that. And I found it quite cool. I mean, I know that Muriel, you say in your brilliant review that it's bittersweet, which it certainly is, but it's quite, the temperature is quite cool. There's a sort of big shouty scene, a big sort of acting with a capital A scene, which I didn't really buy, not because they're not very good, they are very good, but you could almost see the setup being done.
I agree with you. I actually went with that. I think I felt a little bit what you felt, but I went with it along the lines of, this is a film about actors going through an ordinary human situation, but it's also a film about how ordinary people are actors, that we always perform our emotions, and that anyone who's been in a bit of a domestic will know deep down that however much you are really feeling in the moment, you're also using tropes from films or TV, because that's what you use to express yourself authentically in the moment.
Yes,
and
that's actually a really interesting way of seeing it. And Noah Baumbach is very smart. So
all of that stuff must
be on purpose. The bit I thought that was really terrific was almost the last, there's a little, very short scene at the end when the dad is sitting with his son, and his son has found the list that you talk about where they write about what they love about each other.
Yeah.
And his son doesn't know what it is and is just reading it out because he's practicing. And then the dad takes over. And that's a beautiful scene, very moving, by far the most moving thing.
Did it feel a bit schematic? I just wondered whether, because the opening scene is them reading out these loving words to each other, and it's clever. It's really, as a conceit, it's a really clever conceit, and then it's picked up at the end of the movie where they're not reading it into a divorce, obviously, the son's reading, and therefore it is genuine. It is a moment where they can live with each other, still divorced, but they're going to get through it, is I suppose, the thrust of it all. Does that ruin the film?
Well, it's too late now, you've said it.
It's very carefully constructed. Yeah. But then again, the performances are so good and the language, the writing is so good that it carries you off with it. I think a lesser cast, weaker writing, and probably it would have felt a bit thin and a bit sort of papier-mâché. But
I did think it was too long.
Everything's too long.
Everything is
too long.
But also I was thinking about While We're Young. This podcast is not nearly long enough. While We're Young, the earlier one that I was mentioning, and I really thought that was a brilliant film and interesting in all sorts of ways. And I looked it up, and that's 1 hour 37.
Yes, and it's the perfect length.
It's
for a
the perfect yeah, exactly length,
right, isn't it?
But they don't make.
If you've taken 15, 20 minutes out of it,
no, they don't. But it's so rare that you see a film that, I mean, under 2 hours, and you're standing and applauding when you read
that. I mean, it's only really animation sometimes that still strays on that side.
I mean, this didn't feel... This was over 2 hours, wasn't it?
Mm. Yeah.
The Irishman is 3 hours...
That felt every bit as long as it was to me.
Fear really lived through The Irishman.
I really did. I think I really wanted to like it. You know, there's that whole feeling of, oh, it's everyone together again, all of the films that you loved, and some of the performances are great. Al Pacino is excellent in it. And
does he play Jimmy Hoffa?
Yeah. And yet it felt like a film made towards the end of a career that's the kind of... not the culmination of all of the films that have gone before, which is what it was being pitched as, but just a sort of more of the same and longer. And I think we've also done that whole thing of a gangster reckons with his life and reconciles himself with what he's done and the damage he's done before, and I just wasn't convinced.
Is there an argument, I wonder, that there's this sort of fantasy filmmaking that Netflix do? Because they've got so much money, they can sort of say, Scorsese, get together De Niro, Pacino, Pesci, you've got 4.5 hours, you've got the amazing technology, so you don't even need to get to hire younger actors. Yeah. And it's almost kind of film school porn, isn't it? It's kind of taken a Scorsese film to the nth degree because you can.
And not enough constraints.
Exactly, not enough constraints. The question is whether in the old school kind of studio way they would have said, and keep it to a certain time length and we want this, and we, you know, maybe think about an ending along these lines. Whether Netflix are just completely hands off because they're so in awe of the genius that they've brought to their platform.
The counterargument to that would be Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which has done incredibly well in the Oscar nominations. In lots of respects, it's kind of beautifully shot, it's kind of beautifully acted, but it's stupid, and it's self-indulgent, and it's boring, and the violence is naff, and it smirks, and it's a kind of exercise in directorial onanism from a man who is kind of in love with the film industry, and that's a studio production. And I kind of wonder whether it's not Netflix, it's big name, if you're Tarantino and Scorsese. We talked about this before, actually, with novelists. No one tells you.
You could lose chapter four and get rid of this person.
I mean, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood could lose an hour and it'd be a better movie for it.
And it tells across the Oscar nominations as well, because I think it was the BBC pointed out that the Oscar nominations for Best Actor and Supporting Actor, the average age is something like 72.
Is it really?
Or something really high, because we're lauding people for the whole of their career rather than the one performance.
Same Margaret, as
the Booker.
The Margaret Atwood
exactly,
problem.
The Booker discussion. Yes.
Who's nominated for Best Actor, Lucy? You've got a list professionally in front of you.
I've been very professional about this. For the Oscars, it's Joaquin Phoenix for Joker, Adam Driver for Marriage Story, Leonardo DiCaprio, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Antonio Banderas, Pain and Glory, which I haven't seen, is supposed to be wonderful.
Have
and
apparently
he is wonderful in that.
Have you seen it, Muriel?
Wonderful. Yes, and there, again, you get the payoff from a long association between a director and an actor who's an alter ego. It's very...
But not self-indulgent. Not self-indulgent.
No, I didn't think so.
And it's not that Almodovar has never been self-indulgent. He is known to it, but he seems to be kind of paring back and...
becoming soberer. Yeah. Yes, I thought so too.
Oh, and the other one is Jonathan Pryce for The Two Popes.
Which I've also seen, and it is pretty good. That's a very chamber piece, small movie. It's Anthony Hopkins and Jonathan Pryce as the two most recent popes. And it was once a play, and it feels like a play. It's two men on stage, and it's their conversations in the Vatican in the Pope's summer palace. They watch football, and they talk a bit about clerical abuse, but not as much as you probably want them to. And they talk about the being the Pope and the fate of the Catholic Church and, you know, materiality and stuff like that.
Sounds very Paolo Sorrentino.
How
long is it?
It sounds kind of long.
No, it's only like 2 hours, I think. No, I don't know. You're not tempted by it?
I am tempted.
It's not that tempting as Cell.
I'm not tempted by that Cell at all.
I am. I like the Cell on screen.
Do you? Well, you're Italian.
That's just
genetics. Yeah. Mira would like to take the Pope to Avignon, and then she'd be interested. I had to watch it because of I interviewed Jonathan Pryce, and he's been nominated, as you say, for an Oscar. Yes. He's 70 something. That's his first ever nomination, I think. And they are very good in it, in a sort of very thespy way. It's two old great actors,
both Welsh.
I just can't bear that thing where you know you're going to see some acting.
Yes,
you know what I mean. I just can't bear it.
Well, yeah, but that's
acting
that's,
with a capital A.
But that's
yeah,
true.
And
of
really
all...
good actors don't do it. But in that setup, it's just like it, they might as well put for the strapline. Come and see two great people acting. That's you know,
which is the same. I mean, The Irishman's the same, surely. Yeah. And also, did you mind the CGI sort of youth process?
I didn't like it at all.
What's that?
Also,
like?
His eyes.
Yeah.
You're not sending it.
Yeah. Did you watch it all the way through?
I did.
In one go?
I did, but
did
I...
Did you stop it?
No, I watched it in the cinema, so I couldn't leave. And I actually felt... Yeah. I also had a pain in my foot at the time, so it became really existential. I felt so trapped.
I'm not sure we can blame Scorsese entirely
for that. It just went on and on,
and
I couldn't
Scorsese
leave.
Make your foot?
Yeah. Quentin Tarantino would be interested in your foot.
Oh, of course he would. Don't tell him.
Yeah. Oh, not
in a kind and helpful way. Yeah. And actually, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, that's the bit that I actually was open-mouthed in that, because he likes feet, he likes movies. And Margot Robbie at one point is barefoot in a cinema watching herself on the screen.
Having
in the
said
kind
about
of,
seven words.
Yeah, she doesn't say anything. And then it's a 60s movie, so it's right in Tarantino kind of Proustian relish for the past. And then the camera just lingers on her dirty feet, and you kind of think, really? I mean, yeah, good luck to you pursuing your interest, but is this for everyone? And I kind of felt that it was well acted, and it was... It's very lush, and I do like Tarantino. You know, I'm the age where when Pulp Fiction came out, it was a massive moment, and you thought, oh, I can't believe films exist like that, and the colour and the sort of the verve of them. But this is his ninth film, and this is the point about, you know, are we just having victory lap movies?
The fact of the violence being as delayed as it is, and then it all comes all sort of in one scene, it really felt like they were playing with the audience's expectations, and it was like an in-joke of, you know it's coming, and then it...
What did you think of the violence, Muriel, at the end? Did it bother you?
No.
Okay. Did you want more?
That probably says something about me. No, it didn't bother me. I was certainly mesmerised by it. I couldn't quite believe what I was seeing, and at the same time...
It was silly though, wasn't it?
Yes, it's cartoonish, which makes it more palatable, again, disturbingly, because it's easier to separate from it, and also because the Manson children are so demonic that we are able to not look at them as human beings at all, I suppose.
Yeah.
And also because we know what's coming to Sharon. I mean, I did enjoy the movie a lot more than you, Stig, I think. I skipped a few Tarantinos. So I came back to it with this. And I did enjoy the movie. And also, I thought actually the strange parallel reality or pre-reality of the terrible thing that's going to happen to Sharon Tate worked quite well, because it does create pathos. For me, it did.
Because the one thing it didn't feel for me was that.
Even though the film does treat her like the starlet that she was, you do still look at her and think, this is the end of innocence, the end of the 60s. I went along with that. It worked for me.
I did think the two main leads in it, I think Brad Pitt plays himself, but very well.
Yes.
And in a very, you know, it's very impressive. He's a genuine superstar, and you feel that. And Leonardo DiCaprio actually has an acting role and acts it very well, I think, this sort of failed, slightly seedy, over-the-hill actor.
Were you not moved by the scene where he really nails it and the child actor says, I've never seen anything like it. And he breaks down. It is parodic, but also quite moving. I thought it walked that line quite
and
well.
Tarantino
it's very
is
Tarantino.
And Tarantino is, I mean, because I only watched this one because I had to interview DiCaprio and Brad Pitt. And apparently when Tarantino films, and you can either like this or this sounds like your idea of hell, he often just stops and they sit around and tell stories about movies. Because he's... Because
with
he's,
their shoes on or off?
No, the ladies take their shoes off, of course. Imagine. But the idea being that this is a sort of love affair with films. And if you're there because he's got so much, like all these people, they don't have a, they have a budget, but the budget I imagine is a bit hazy. They have a time pressure, but the time pressure is more hazy because they're so big. They get a chance to.
So I suppose one of the problems there, maybe with the Tarantino and maybe also with other films, is that it's a bit meta.
Yeah.
And
I'd say, that's Marriage Story. I'd say that's true of Marriage Story.
Because yeah. There have been comparisons with other directors, but Woody Allen in particular, I suppose. That is he the inheritor?
Do you like Woody Allen?
I love Woody Allen.
Do you?
Yes, I love Woody Allen, and I've
only really seen his last 20 years have been so awful.
Yes, some of the early stuff is amazing, and also I like to see the whole arc. I mean, to me, it's a bit like Eric Rohmer, who is also an influence on Baumbach, by the way, whose son is called Rohmer, I discovered.
Oh, really?
His first son from his first marriage, for he too has been through divorce.
Yeah.
He's very much in debt to these two people, and he's not the new Woody Allen in the sense that Woody Allen was the first Woody Allen. You know, Woody Allen invented a certain kind of cinema. Eric Rohmer invented a certain kind of cinema that you might like or find very irritating. But they were the first ones to coin that. So maybe we're waiting for a new wave of filmmakers who are going to reinvent the storytelling.
I liked what you said about it in the piece, that the film was a sort of musical theatre by stealth,
yes.
Almost, because it's got rather stagey music. And I was thinking, this is slightly odd. It's a bit like an intro to a musical. It's by Randy Newman, the music.
That's right.
I realised at the end.
I was very surprised to see it was Randy Newman.
Yeah, I was too.
And then they do a Sondheim song, doesn't
it? They both do. They both do a song right at the end.
You can imagine that somewhere in a different reality there is a musical version of this film. It wants to be a musical.
Yes. I mean, Fear and I were talking about this morning, because if you got to the stage where you can only express yourself, you can only bring your emotions out by singing, that's what musical theatre is, or opera. I mean, that's what it is. So.
That's a funny mix,
but it's interesting, I think. I know I sound as though I'm slagging it off, but I'm still thinking about it.
There's also a strange trend at the moment, which I think I'm resistant to, which is a movement towards just thinking that if you're going to make a big, successful film, it has to have a song in it and a dance, or preferably both.
Yeah.
Greta Gerwig, who's just done Little Women, which is interesting and maybe we'll talk about. She's said that her next project is going to be a musical involving some tap dance. I think
that had to happen, because I remember reading that when I first saw her in a film, it was in Whit Stillman's Damsels in Distress, which is a fantastic movie, I think, but underrated. And I read somewhere that when she auditioned for Whit Stillman for this movie, she did a tap dance.
Yeah.
So that is clearly
how. Oh, and Frances Ha as well. There's a tap dance, which is now Noah Baumbach with Greta Gerwig in it.
And indeed, not that it matters, but Noah Baumbach and Greta Gerwig are indeed partners in real life.
And then a new power couple.
One recognised at the Oscars and the other not, or, you know, at the various awards.
Well, and that's, I mean, maybe we should talk about Little Women, because who's seen Little Women here?
Yes.
Me.
We've all seen Little Women, which is kind of interesting in and of itself.
Alicia's seen it twice.
Yeah.
Once I paid.
You even paid to see it.
Did you just stay for second screening?
Keeping it real, Lucy. Well done. And arguably, of all the films I've seen, we're talking about, including 1917, which we might get to, the direction in Little Women is its real strength. It's a beautifully, carefully cut together.
It's constructed.
And it's the one that's not been nominated for Best Director.
If it was a quilt or something, it would be really beautifully done.
And it's not too long. And as you say, it's structured. So the timeline. The timeline is interesting.
Yep.
The way she cuts between the two illnesses that Beth has to structure it that way.
And really
it
makes
really
think about the plight of the writer as well.
Where they make the book at the end.
Yeah.
My favourite scene in the whole film, and I think possibly my favourite scene in the whole of the year, is when it's the girls and they're doing a sort of gentleman's dining club in the attic.
It's the Pickwick Club and the Pickwick Papers. Yeah.
And they're sitting there, they're pretending to smoke pipes, and they've got top hats on, and they're just taking the mickey out of each other. And then Laurie bursts out of a cupboard and they say, can we have Laurie? No, we can't have him, he's a man. And then they welcome him in. And the whole thing, it's both kind of joyous and bubbling over, and yet very tightly controlled. I think that's the trick in this film, that it feels sort of exuberant.
But not silly.
And when you actually reflect on it, you were saying this, Lisa, you can see cuts that have been very deliberate, you know, and echoes and mirrors that work.
And it's not the same thing every time. Sometimes it's an angle that someone is looking at, or sometimes it's a memory, or sometimes it's a place.
Or sometimes it's just a beautiful scene.
Yeah.
And the thought that if you lift the camera and look down at all of these swirling dresses going up the stairs, it will look amazing.
The clothes are brilliant, because basically Saoirse Ronan playing Joe and Laurie, who is...
Timothy Chalamet.
And they're a real-life power couple, of course, themselves. They both could look like they'd swap clothes and you wouldn't really even notice that much.
And they would quite enjoy swapping clothes and that would be fine.
I would love Laurie's outfit.
So do I. I would love Laurie's outfit. Yeah, exactly.
I read there was a horrible thread on Twitter the other day about the film, attacking the film on the basis of the hairstyles. I don't know if you've seen this. Because the hairstyles are too modern, too contemporary. They don't wear their hair up in that dreadfully unflattering way, and also their hair isn't greasy enough, you know, all of that stuff.
Well, also, they're all too good looking.
They're all too good looking, which I thought was...
Imagine you came across them, like the babysitter in Marriage Story, you'd be like, this is ridiculous.
It is, but you know, it's a movie, and I thought it was like quite a dreary, sort of mean-spirited attack.
I think the look of that film is... I mean, and also the book is, let's be honest, the book is a bit saccharine. It's not a... I mean, there's an element of realism to it, and she's a sort of figure in realism, clearly, Louisa May Alcott, but it's not that realist. It's a sentimental book that you're entitled to take things from and play with. It's not a...
I think the film elevates the book. I love the book. I'm, you know, I grew up reading it in French translation. So I've never actually read it in English. Yeah. But I thought the film did that very well, to take something that is perhaps... second tier literature and elevate it to first class cinema.
And Florence Pugh, who plays
she's amazing.
She plays so good. It's brilliant. And she's been
She gets nominated.
She's nominated, yeah.
Yeah, well, and Laura Dern's not nominated for this. She's nominated for Marriage Story.
Mm-hmm. In which she is remarkable.
Also brilliant in
Do we feel that Marriage... We probably have to end this, because we could talk about this all day. Do we think that the... I thought the lawyers were the most fun things in... Alan Alda's great in it. Ray Liotta's great in it. And Laura Dern...
Laura Dern is amazing. There's a scene where, well, she's absolutely fantastic at using her physicality, because she has these sort of serpentine limbs, doesn't she? So she's sort
always
of infinite somehow. Yeah. And pointy shoes and apologising for looking schleppy when she looks incredibly well-groomed. Yeah. But also there's a scene in court during a hearing where she strategically removes her jacket and she's wearing a sort of minuscule athleisure, I think it's called, a pink top, and makes pink a really scary colour in that moment, because she's sort of bearing herself for attack. I can't imagine anyone else being able to pull that off.
And to your point about performative, the lawyers in it are they're exactly doing the same thing. They are playing the game, because they kill each other in course and then they go off and have dinner afterwards.
Like, and they all have a hearty appetite. There's a great scene where all the lawyers are rubbing their hands because it's lunchtime.
And the traumatised husband and wife are
well,
like,
she has to order for them.
Yes.
I found that whole thread a bit odd. What she orders for him, and at the end that she does his shoes up.
Yeah.
I found that a bit mystifying.
Well, there's a whole other thread about marriage and being a good wife and what that means, which is something perhaps for another day, but where perhaps the film is not as groundbreaking as it wants to be.
Isn't it that she can't get out of it, as it were?
It's not the dynamic of being there.
But also she's being helpful, because she doesn't want him to trip over when he's got the boy and he's carrying.
But
I have to say also, in Marriage Story, the boy is brilliant. He was just absolutely brilliant. I thought you wouldn't have known he was acting. It was just like a kid throwing himself around the place.
That's right.
We should leave it. What top film then that's been nominated? What would you like to see do well in this? Are we saying Marriage Story?
Little Women.
Am I the only one who's seen 1917?
So I almost went to see it, and then I decided to see Uncut Gems instead, and I think I'm glad I did.
Okay, well, 1917, I saw. It's amazingly shot. Mm. It is a magnificent piece of filmmaking. But my problem with it, go and see it and let me know what you think, because I found that I got to the end of a First World War movie and I didn't feel moved, because I felt impressed. Mm. And that, now some people think I'm completely wrong, and I've said that on the radio, and someone said, no, it's rubbish, I was entirely moved. So maybe I am wrong, but it felt to me that it felt like a bit like a computer game, the idea of the swooping camera that follows one character to around, and it felt like you were just looking at a piece of cinematography and filmmaking that was kind of awesome. But I'm not sure that's what I want from a...
Dunkirk.
Yeah, the sort of scale of it was too... And it's because it's an intimate movie in the sense it just follows two people the whole way, and they get to a French village that's been blown up and it looks like something out of Bosch. You know, the colour... Or Blake, you know, the colours are sort of... It looks like hell. And the colours are amazing, and these flares are going up, and it's an incredible thing to look at. And at the same time, it's about these two guys, so it has an intimacy. But, yeah... I think it will do ridiculously well, because it's incredibly auteur-y. Sam Mendes is telling the story his granddad told him. He's due because he's 20 years since American Beauty. It feels like a very safe bet for Oscar voters to give it to. It's not the sort of bombast of Scorsese and Tarantino. I just wonder whether that will...
Maybe
that will
do.
That will
well.
Do well. But Little Women will win some actor roles. You'd have thought.
I hope so. You've got to hope so.
It's the year of Laura Dern, clearly, because she's the yeah. mother.
Will she ever do anything better than Jurassic Park?
Yes, I think just she did. Has.
Fine, Mira Ozaga, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you,
Lucy. Thank you for coming downstairs.
I think it was a long way, but I managed.
Well done.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Virginia Woolf once wrote that London itself perpetually attracts, stimulates, gives me a play and a story and a poem without any trouble save that of moving my legs through the streets. Well, London, actually just a small part of it, has given Francesca Wade her first book, Square Hauntings, an account of how five women made their literary lives in Mecklenburg Square near Bloomsbury between the wars. The women are Woolf herself, the poet H.D., the crime writer Dorothy Sayers, the Cambridge classicist Jane Ellen Harrison, and the historian Eileen Power. Their lives are fascinating, needless to say, in themselves, but also paint a broader picture of the intellectual position of women in the mid-century. A square of one's own, if you like. Thea sat down to hear more from Francesca, and here is a little bit from the interview.
Yeah, well, Mecklenburg Square is situated right out on the eastern edge of Bloomsbury, which, as an area that we know today, is pretty different both in looks and in kind of atmosphere and feel from how it was both when the area was set out and when these women were living there. Bloomsbury was originally conceived by the original landowners as a sort of upper middle class suburb. The Duke of Bedford commissioned these grand houses to be built on his estate, but by the time they were all finished, any family who was rich enough to buy one wanted to live out in West London, which is much more fashionable. So the houses got kind of divided up into flats, and the area became known as a kind of a place of transition. I think there's a quote Marjorie Allingham in the introduction, who in the 1930s said that the area was somewhere where if you lived there, you were either on your way up or on your way down. And it was really a place where at this time single people who wanted to live on their own or with friends in flats or boarding houses could congregate. And it very much had a literary reputation because the British Museum reading room was right in Bloomsbury's heart, which was open to all to and read and study.
And it's clear that for all of the women that you write about here, in different ways and at different stages in their lives, Mecklenburg Square, it represented a kind of experiment in selfhood, I suppose, and an alternative to that, to a title to the book could be something along the lines of How Should a Woman Be? Or even How to Be Both.
Yeah, what I was interested in and the conceit of the book was to examine all of these women's lives during the period that they happened to live in Mecklenburg Square, which began when I discovered that so many interesting characters had congregated in this one place, which at first when I discovered it seemed like it must be a complete coincidence. And what I wanted to do in the research for this book was, I suppose, ask why it was that they had all been drawn to this place and what they were kind of looking for there and what the place represented to each of them. And of the five that I write about, Eileen Power was the only one who lived there for more than a few years. But the more I researched, the more it seemed to me that each one of them moved there at a formative time in their lives, in a period of transition or of kind of redefinition of themselves. So maybe we'll get on to how they each what they were each sort of looking to do. But
well, certainly for all of the women who, even those who moved there in the early part of their career when they were really setting out, so you think of HD and Dorothy Sayers in particular. Mm. Let's start with HD and let's try to move chronologically as you do, but there's a very clear sense that her time in the square, even though I think she was only there for 2 years, it stayed with her. She had to resolve a kind of, break free of or resolve a creative and personal crisis that was really set in motion in that time.
Yeah, absolutely. HD was born in America and she came to London in 1911. She lived in various addresses around London. But these years in Mecklenburg Square were really crucial through her life to her kind of sense of herself. In the 30s, she had a long period of analysis with Freud to deal with a kind of writer's block that she'd been experiencing. And he told her that he thought that these years during the First World War, when she'd happened to have been living in Mecklenburg Square, were key to these personal tangles that she was struggling with. And he urged her to return to writing a novel that she'd been writing on and off over the last decade, which explored everything that happened in the square and in the years just before and after she moved there. So she arrived there during the First World War in 1916. Quite soon after they moved in, her husband, Richard Aldington, was called up and had to go away to fight. So she was left there on her own. And when he came back, he was having an affair with the woman who lived upstairs called Arabella York. So she was in this very difficult position of having to see him and having to see him go upstairs and not really want to spend time with her. She was in a kind of personal crisis with her own writing. She kept sort of tearing up the poems that she was working on. She was really in a state of transition, I think, within her poetry as well. Her name, HD, was given to her by Ezra Pound, who she'd briefly been engaged to in America and who really seized on some of her early verses as representative of this movement, Imagism, that he was kind of championing. He really admired them for their kind of clarity and directness and their focus on kind of moments of natural beauty. But during the war, HD started translating from ancient Greek and started focusing on particularly the female choruses of Euripides, who are often kind of standing by powerless while they watch men be destroyed at war. And I think it's a kind of powerful comment on the personal crisis that she was experiencing in this year.
And this thing of trying to find a voice that is true to the woman that she is and the woman that she wants to be and the society that she wants to be a part of, all of that. I mean, I suppose it would be remiss of me not to point out that you've also, as well as this wonderful book, you've also written an introduction to a book published by the TLS just now. We've got this imprint. And the book is called Genius in Ink, Virginia Woolf on How to Read. And it's a collection of her reviews and essays for the TLS. So it's worth mentioning, not only because reading those pieces by Woolf on George Eliot and Elizabeth Barrett Browning and Charlotte Bronte, you see Woolf wrestling with many of the ideas that you go over and bring to the fore in your book, but also because you mentioned there how Woolf wrestled with this, I think she called it, or you called it, a phantom voice, the expectation that in her writing and her reviewing she would be womanly.
Yeah. Well, Woolf is a kind of guiding spirit to the book in a way, because her book, A Room of One's Own, was very formative for me, both kind of personally and also in the way that I came to conceive of what might have brought all these women to Mecklenburg Square. And Room of One's Own is partly a literal statement. Woolf says that for a woman who wants to be a writer, you need £500 a year and a room of your own. But the room, as well as being a physical reminder that you need to write, you need space, you need not to be interrupted. It's also a metaphor, I guess, for being taken seriously and for having these... She's asking what conditions you need in order to fulfil your creative potential. And I think that's what all of the women in this book were really asking when they moved to the square and when they set up their lives there and when they thought about who they wanted to share it with or how they wanted to decorate or what sort of work they wanted to do there. And I think for HD, those questions were incredibly important because she had always been sort of defined by other people around her, particularly by men. I mean, from quite a young age, Ezra Pound really took her under his wing, which was exciting, informative and important, but also she came to find increasingly stifling. She later wrote that she you know, she had to sort of get away from him. She knew that if she'd married him when they were quite young, she would never have been able to become a writer herself. And I think these are the questions that she was going over and over in the novels, that in this cycle of novels that she wrote through her life, which culminated in 1960, the year before she died. She finally published a version of this ongoing novel. The rest she wrote destroy on the manuscripts, although they did survive and in fact have subsequently since her death been published. So you can see how the story kind of developed and the different emphases she put over the years. But the crux of this final novel that she published in 1960, Bid Me to Live, is this disagreement she had with D.H. Lawrence, kind of rooted in the months when he came to stay with her in Mecklenburg Square. The book ends by her writing a letter to this character who's clearly based on Lawrence, and they've clearly had an argument where he's essentially told her that women should only write about women's experiences. They shouldn't try to speak for men or speak universally. And she writes a really moving, powerful letter back, which in fact has some kind of linguistic echoes with The Room of One's Own, where she says, you know, in order to be free, I have to be able to write as I want, and I can't be constrained by what anyone wants of me or what expects me to be. And I think that is kind of emblematic of what all of these women in very different ways were looking for.
Thea and Francesca Wade, Square Hauntings, Five Women, Freedom and London Between the Wars by Francesca Wade is out now.
As regular listeners will know, since 2016 we've been marking the Bronte bicentenary, which began with a commemoration of Charlotte Bronte, born in 1816, followed by Emily 2 years later. Now, finally, we turn to Anne Bronte, the baby Bronte, who died in 1849 in Scarborough. And there she was buried, away from the family plot back in Haworth, with a tombstone riddled with errors. For one thing, her age was recorded incorrectly. She was 29, not 28. An error which even somehow survived her sister Charlotte's attentions a year or so later, when the tombstone was replaced. All this is fitting. The way Anne Bronte's life was rounded off is in some ways symptomatic of the way she lived and has been remembered. She's always been seen by most as the lesser Bronte, plodding, in life as in bicentenary celebrations, in the wake of her older sisters, and as something of an outlier when it comes to the family's supreme talents. Understanding of her two novels, Agnes Grey and The Tenant of Wildfell Hall, has, like her tombstone, been plagued by mistakes. And her sister Charlotte has played a considerable part in this too. Here to set the record straight is Samantha Ellis. Hello, Samantha.
Hi, hello.
I suppose before we set the record straight, we should probably look at how the record came to be in the first place. How did the prevailing idea of Anne and her work come about?
Well, really through Charlotte. Charlotte was the only surviving sibling of the Brontes. She was grieving, obviously, so making all these decisions in the depth of her grief. But she also, I believe, had some very fixed views about her sister. I mean, obviously, it's slightly difficult to say she was wrong. She knew her sister. We didn't. But from the record, it does seem that she underestimated her little sister. She always saw her as the baby. She always saw her as angelic. There's a story where she thought she saw an angel over Anne's cradle when she was a baby. And so she always sort of saw her as this kind of angelic figure. She describes her as sweet and mild and blameless. And she sort of saw her as being quite dejected and melancholy, very pious. And I'm not sure that really fits with the kind of fierce, radical writing that we find in Anne's work. And also, even in her very witty and sort of sparky and courageous letters, there's only five of them, but they don't sound like, for want of a better word, this wimp. She sounds a lot more gutsy than that. Anyway, Charlotte had these views, which she described Anne and Emily in a sort of biographical notice, which was the first sort of mini biography of the Bronte sisters. And she also then talked a lot about Anne to Elizabeth Gaskell, who was became Charlotte's first biographer. And so that really set the tone for how Anne was seen. But also she didn't like Anne's second novel, The Tenant of Wildfell Hall, so she refused to allow any reprints in her lifetime. It was a bestseller when Anne died, and it fell very quickly out of print. And the only book left that people could read was Agnes Grey, her first novel, which is a wonderful book, but, you know, it doesn't have the sort of fierceness of The Tenant of Wildfell Hall. But also, even that, that she didn't think Anne's fiction was as good as Emily's, and that's stuck on the front of every edition of Agnes Grey.
They don't put that on the editions, so. Did they put that on the editions?
Well, it was in the biographical notice, yeah, so...
I suppose they have to. Was Charlotte trying to protect her own literary reputation in this? She didn't want any comparisons?
Certainly with Agnes Grey, there was an issue about comparisons, because Agnes Grey was a novel about a plain, not as in definitely not beautiful, governess who sets off for work, goes through two different jobs and finds love at the end, and faces all sorts of trials in between. And Anne had written it before Charlotte thought to write about a plain governess who also... has her trials and finds love. Unfortunately for Anne, Jane Eyre came first. So then Agnes Grey seemed like it was just another, oh no, not another governess novel, and she also isn't pretty. So there was a comparison issue. I think with The Tenant of Wealdwell Hall, it's more complex. I think partly it's a story of a young woman who is very beautiful, who falls for a sexy, dangerous cad, like all the other Bronte heroines. Yeah. But... she sees the light and she leaves him, and that does not happen in any of Charlotte or Emily's work. It was in part a critique of Jane Eyre and of Wuthering Heights, and was partly saying, why did you make these men so attractive? Why did you make these horrible men? You know, Heathcliff and Rochester are not nice guys. Why did you make them romantic heroes? This is not love's young dream. It shouldn't be.
Well, and also presumably wasn't true to the experience that they'd had with their own brother.
No, who was a sort of, you know, self-destructive, alcoholic, drug addict, fiercely creative. He was always writing, he was always drawing, he was painting, but he never quite made anything of himself. He was sort of brought down by his addictions and by circumstance. You know, they didn't have much money, they didn't know many people. He tried to go to art school in London, no one quite knows why it didn't work out. But he did sort of end up, you know, living this really tragic life where he's living in his father's house and going out and getting wasted, sometimes for days at a time, and then having to be hauled up the stairs by his sisters because he can't get to bed. And he's sleeping in his father's room because he's so out of it that he can't be trusted to sleep in his own room. Anne discovered him one night when he was still in his own room with his bed on fire because he sort of knocked out the candle when he was fallen asleep. Or into a sort of drunken stupor and knocked out his own candle. He didn't become this hero that perhaps he and his sisters wanted him to be, but Anne saw that.
Well, and so, I mean, to Emily and Charlotte's romanticism, she brings a really diligent realism. You make the case that both Agnes Grey and The Tenant, they're both sort of like campaign novels in a sense. Mm.
Yes, I think so. I mean, Agnes Grey is really very closely based on her own experience as a governess. And I mean, all three sisters did teaching jobs. Charlotte and Anne both worked as governesses in private homes and both really had a horrible time. I mean, they were treated badly. This is a horrible incident where Charlotte was a governess and one of the children threw a stone at her forehead and cut her forehead. There's another incident where one of the children said to Charlotte that they loved Charlotte, and the mother just went, love the governess, you know, horrified. And Anne also had a really difficult time at both of her jobs. And yet you look at Jane Eyre and she's got this lovely pupil, Adele, a joy to teach, you know, charming, pretty, maybe not the academic star that, you know, you'd want, but she's happy to, very teachable girl, like lovely girl, lovely company. She's got Mrs. Fairfax, the lovely housekeeper, plenty of free time to go for long walks and read. You know, it that was not Anne's experience or Charlotte's experience. And in Agnes Grey, you see her really going through the mill and having a tough time.
And then with The Tenant of Wealdwell Hall, are we in the realm? It feels, certainly from your version in this essay, that this feels like a book that, if it wasn't quite of its time back in the 19th century, because it is rather too challenging, it may have found its moment in the 21st century, because it's about a woman who fights against a sort of patriarchal system. There is sexual violence, there's gaslighting, there is abuse, but it's not abuse that is somehow romanticised away that it may, which may happen in other Brontes. It's confronted and it's dealt with.
Yes, I mean, I wish it had found its moment when she wrote it, because, you know, it would have helped. I'm sure it did help a lot of women who read it, but I think it would have helped a lot more. But it's still helping women. You know, while I was writing my book on Anne Bronte, someone sent me an article from the Sydney Morning Herald, and it was an anonymous article by a woman who had been in an abusive marriage in Australia with a man who, he was abusive in every way, but one of the things he did was censor her reading. Anyway, one day she came home, she writes this piece, she came home with a copy of The Tenant and Wildfell Hall. He was like, oh, okay, just another Victorian romance, go ahead. So she reads it, and she realised that if 150 years ago Anne Bronte had written this story of this woman leaving an abusive marriage, why was she staying in her marriage? And she walked out. She had the courage. It gave her the courage to walk out. I mean, that's in her own words. It still has that impact on the people who need to hear it.
But as a piece of writing, I mean, it has a piece of writing, because are you tempted, are we tempted, because it has politics that chime better with our age, because it's been overlooked, are we inclined to look on it with too kind of forgiving an eye? I mean, as a piece of literature, is it possible to make the case for it above Jane Eyre or above Wuthering Heights, do you think, as a piece of literary work?
I think The Tenant of Wildfell Hall is a phenomenal book. I really do think it's amazingly written. I mean, not everyone agrees. Tracy Chevalier's written a wonderful introduction to the New Folio Society edition of it, and she doesn't like the frame. She finds it a sort of clumsy setup. But then she says, when we get into the main part of the novel, which is the heroine's diary, it's a sensational in every way piece of writing. That's what Tracy Chevalier said, and that's a novelist writing about another novelist. So not everyone loves everything about it, but I think it's got a power you can't really deny, not just because of its politics. Yeah. And it's also, there's a lot of humour in it, in both novels. I think people miss the humour because, there is a lot of religion in both of the novels. Anne was much more religious than her sisters, I think.
And that doesn't feel modern, does it? That's possibly makes her seem more of her age.
Yes, but she does say in the Agnes Grey, the end of religion is to teach us how to live. It's not about just, do you believe in this or do you believe in that? It's what are you going to do with that? How are you going to live your life? How are you going to bring your values into your life now? And what do you believe? And I think that's really important, because I think we're questioning our values all the time now. And it actually feels quite modern to me to sort of go, in The Tenant of Wildfell Hall, the heroine leaves her husband. That's not allowed. that wasn't legal at the time. But also, many would have called it immoral. No, you stay with him no matter what. She leaves him. You can break the law. You can break morality. But doing the right thing doesn't always mean doing what people think you ought to be doing.
That's a really interesting point, actually, because it was her Christianity that clearly gave her that sense of a higher moral world in the legal system just hadn't caught up with.
Yes, the church, many. I mean, Patrick Bronte, her father, had advised a woman to leave her abusive and alcoholic husband, and Anne knew about this, and this was partly the inspiration for The Tenant of Wildfell Hall. But he was very unusual. I mean, he used to baptise illegitimate children, which very, very few clergymen would do at the time. He, at one point, when the poor laws were being rolled out in Yorkshire, he urged his congregation to rebel revolt, actually. He used the word revolt. He was quite an unusual clergyman. I mean, that was not, the church was not in favour of women leaving their husbands, even if they were alcoholics, unfaithful, abusive. It did give her something to lean on, but also she's all about finding your own values and your own way. And I find that very powerful myself, but also very modern, I think.
We have to leave it here, Samantha, but are you saying, if you had to pick a Bronte novel of the Bronte, there's not that many of them, it's a pretty fierce competition. Are you making the case for Tenant of Wildfell Hall as the uber Bronte novel?
Oh, it's so difficult. I'm going to be really rubbish. I can't choose.
You don't have to.
Yes, she does have to.
So
of course you have to.
No, I grew up with... You see, I think you have different Bronte novels for different parts of your life. And I grew up with Wuthering Heights, and that was... If you'd asked me at any time between 12 and 35 or so, I'd have said Wuthering Heights is the only one. I had a brief Jane Eyre phase. And I think
Villette's quite is quite a cool one to throw out there.
The Connoisseur.
The Connoisseur's Choice, the persuasion to Wuthering Heights' Pride and Prejudice.
yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm prepared to believe I may go through more revolutions, but I think that's one of the exciting things. They had their sibling rivalry, and their novels were compared to each other, and then we're still doing it.
Yeah.
It sort of fuels the legacy, I suppose, this constant putting one against the other and making them fight.
But they
for...
were also, they were in conversation with each other. Yeah. They were, you know, they were having the argument. So we're just continuing the argument they started. And I don't think they would mind us doing that.
No. Have you ever read Cold Comfort Farm, Samantha?
I love Cold
One
Comfort
of my favourite
Farm,
lines yeah. in it is, is it my bug? And he yes. basically, his theory is that all the novels of the Brontes were written by Bramwell.
Well, if that's the case, we've no need for any sibling rivalry. Yeah.
I've got a feeling.
He was too busy setting fire to his
yeah,
own bed.
I've got a feeling.
It came out after he died, but maybe, I don't know, he'd hidden them under his pillow. And yeah.
Well, that doesn't stop people saying Shakespeare didn't write Shakespeare, because they've got people who died in 1604 still writing Shakespeare plays. But that's the subject of a whole other podcast.
I mean, I wrote some.
Yeah, we've all had a go. Samantha, what a great joy. You know what? I've not read Tenet of Wildfire Hall, or if I have, I've read it a long time ago. So I'm going to go off now, thanks to you, and read it.
Oh, okay, fantastic. Lovely. Thank you very much.
Samantha Ennis, thank you so much for coming on.
Pleasure, thank you.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Muriel Zaga and Lucy Dallas, Samantha Ellis and Francesca Wade. Make sure you're subscribing to the TLS so you don't miss a word. Online, we have launched a new series called Originals with all sorts of weird and wonderful subjects. Plus, in the paper this week, we have All That Bronte, plus the French Revolution, stories about food, the impact of Instagram and much more. Next week, the theme is design. In all sorts of ways. Intriguing stuff. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.